morning.
Good morning.
Glad you all got out of bed today. Looks like it's going to be a good day, and this is a great way to start it, right? Well, Luke 16, we're making progress. Wow. However, in Luke 16, according to commentators, there is perhaps no single parable that has been subjected to such various and discordant interpretations as the one of the unjust steward. So let's look this morning at the parable of the unjust steward and see what we can find. Luke chapter 16, verse 1. And he said also unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man which had a steward. And the same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods. Okay, so a steward is a person who has the authority to manage the goods of somebody else. Some people have so much stuff, they can't keep track of it. You have that problem? I kind of have that problem, but the stuff that I have is not really manageable. It just kind of sits in a pile, so it's not a problem, after all. But some people have the kind of goods that are of greater value and need to be managed actively, and that was this situation. At any rate, the accusation came up that he had wasted his goods. And he, that is the rich man, called him, that is the steward, and said unto him, how is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest be no longer steward. Okay, so time for an accounting.
Doge.
Indeed. Wow. What a powerful thing, right? Mm-hmm. It is the case that God has given us free will. But he also has instituted accounting. There's various forms of accounting. Certainly, the greatest form is the judgment, the final judgment, where we come before God and give an account for all. But many times during this life, we are called to account. In some ways, every April 15th, you have to give an account to the government for anything that you have earned that year. And then you have to pay if you've earned anything. That's kind of a general statement. Obviously, it's become a system by which the government takes from others and gives to you if you're in certain categories. But it is still kind of accounting because you've got to bring the numbers and see how things measure up. Now, this steward, he didn't defend himself in any way. He didn't say, actually, I've been quite faithful. The reports you've heard of me are not true. There's none of that in this particular case, which is a little unusual. But anyway, that's the way this story goes. He just reckons that my job is done, and so I better make the best use of the remaining moments I have. Okay. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig. To beg I am ashamed. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him, and said unto the first, how much owest thou unto my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take thy bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then said he to another, and how much owest thou? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, take thy bill and write 80. not quite as good a deal, but anyway, it was a good discount. And the Lord commended the unjust steward. And notice that that is the Lord of this story and not the Lord, Jesus. Commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely, for the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. And I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you, to your trust, the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? So there's a bit of a question as to where to stop here. There seem to be some connected things here. Perhaps even the next verse, no man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Okay, so here we have another of Jesus' parables. And the question that would be before us then is, what does Jesus want to teach here? What is his point with this parable? Well, as has been noted, the commentators over the years have struggled with this one a lot. And they have tried to equate the different characters in the parable with all sorts of entities. with God, with maybe Satan, with man, with the Pharisees, with the publicans. There's been a lot of effort to try to plug different ideas into what Jesus is saying here. You can spend many hours just reading what other commentators have done and probably walk away not sure maybe what they've said, but at least what the right answer is. And so with parables, Jesus is usually trying to connect some real thing, some identifiable characteristic of life or trait of human beings that you can connect with and say, yeah, I've experienced that, I've seen that, I know how that works. Trying to connect that to some lesson. Now, let me just say right up front, I'm not going to pretend that I can take and make this real clear to you all of a sudden. Or that I'm fully satisfied with my own understanding. Okay? Clear enough? I do see the point that Jesus is identifying in the parable that is very much characteristic of human nature. And that is, if people are in a position of having a load, having a burden, having a debt, and somebody comes along and relieves them of that, even just to a degree, there's a natural response of gratitude. People tend to be grateful if they're helped out in a way that's, especially if it's unexpected. I didn't see that coming. And it can really mark their minds in a serious way. In fact, in the world of politics and the world of business, a lot of times people create networks around relationships that involve tit for tat, that involve a response because of a thing given in one way or another. That's how the world works. And so what we have here is a picture of somebody who is wise in the ways of the world. He takes a... Sometimes we talk about, can you take a lemon and make lemonade, right? So he takes a failure, he takes a really bad stroke of events in his life and turns it into something that is potentially positive. Now, it's only fair to notice that there's a limit to the kind of goodwill you can generate in this way. You know, it's one thing for somebody to be grateful or relieved that you helped them, but how much can you really depend on them forever? You know what I'm saying?
Because if they're doing it for themselves, it's not going to always come out that way.
And a single easing of one's load, I mean, he didn't wipe their debt out. Mm-hmm. You know, 50% is good. But it's still there. And it's not like this is, in fact, going to create in actual experience a total blank check for all of the future. You could also criticize this guy's plan as short-sighted because this won't work forever. But Jesus is connecting to a real effect that exists in human relationships. And what this is a picture of is how man, even in his failures, because the steward had failed apparently in his job. He hadn't been faithful. There's no defense of his behavior. He didn't defend himself. And so it's presumed that the accounts of his unfaithfulness are true. And so yet in the face of that, he manages to make the best of it. Okay, so what are we to conclude from that? The statement which follows the account goes like this. I say unto you, make to yourself friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations.
That's clear.
It doesn't really sound like something that Jesus would say, actually. And that's part of the rub here. That's part of the challenge in all of this. You might be tempted to say at first, well, maybe he's being a little cynical here. And yet we're kind of uncomfortable with attributing that particular mode of communication with Jesus. He doesn't say, verily, verily here, as sometimes he does. Truly, truly. But it's still not really where we like to land. One of the things we often look for in understanding passages is a broader context, right? Maybe there's something about what's going on in the broader scene here that could help us get insight into this saying. We know that all of chapter 15, with its three parables about the lost, was a response to criticism from the Pharisees that he was associating with the lower classes, the sinners and publicans. We also know that publicans, tax collectors, were a part of the crowd that seems to have connected with Jesus, to the extent that the Pharisees noticed and criticized him for it. And of course, the publicans were those who handled a lot of money. They were also those who had a reputation for being unjust in their dealings and not being good stewards of what they were given, the power they were given. So this concept of stewardship is on the table here. This idea of faithfulness. What about this? And the Pharisees aren't out of the picture even in this chapter. We said they were there in 15, but I didn't read verse 14 here, but at the end of this extended discussion, we're told that the Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things, and they derided him. So they were a part of the congregation here, we could say. They were part of the audience, or part of the recipients of what's going on here. And then let me just also, and if you have any comments or questions that come to your mind along the way, feel free to jump in here, because I'm trying to create some background to think about this in terms of. So what we have here is the parable. Then we have this apparent conclusion that make friends of the mammon. Of course, mammon is a word just which means riches, the riches of unrighteousness. So this is about handling wealth. That when you fail or go bankrupt, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. So we have that, but then we have this observation: he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. Now that sounds more like Jesus, mm-hmm. Right? That's something that you're not surprised to hear him say. That sounds like the kind of thing he would say. And he says, if therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous riches, who will commit to your trust the true riches? If you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? And so for a minute, let's think about this not as by itself. The parable by itself with that conclusion, make to yourself friends of the mammon of unrighteousness and so on, is here. But right after it is this discussion about faithfulness and this question about where true riches lie. And of course, one thing that comes to mind is all the other things Jesus has said about wealth in his ministry. He laments the fact that those who are wealthy are disadvantaged when it comes to salvation because they trust in those things. They don't trust in anything else. They don't think they need anything else. They don't need God. Well, things that you don't need, you won't pay much for. And what Jesus has to offer requires everything. And so that's a lot. So we have those kind of sayings. And we have him saying things like, don't lay up for yourself wealth in this world, but lay up treasures in heaven. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit. There's all kinds of sayings that sort of depreciate the significance of earthly wealth and riches and make them of lesser importance. So that's part of the body of sayings that's behind this. So what if we understand this parable not as a standalone, this is advice from Jesus, this is what you need to do. And of course, if you take it as a standalone in that way, then you end up doing things like in verse 9, that they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Who is the they? Well, some of the commentators decide, well, that's the angels. The angels will receive you into everlasting habitations. You got to get creative, in other words, in order to make it work. I don't know how angels got in this parable at all, but that's what happens if you do that with it. But if you're a listener here to the things that Jesus said, he points at the wisdom of this world. So the wily humans can take a bad situation and make it better with his continued unfaithfulness. I mean, if he hadn't been unfaithful before, he's certainly what the steward was now when he has everybody writing their bill off, right? Or writing it down. So Jesus is not praising that. But if that's the kind of where you, if that's where you are investing your hope, what is the most you can hope for? Well, the most you can hope for is that the people that you pay off, the people that you benefit, the people who get the freebie, you can hope that they will receive you into everlasting habitations.
It sounds a little cynical, right? I mean, is that kind of where we land?
Well, it's kind of... That's...
That's out of his character with the Pharisees, in my understanding, but maybe I'm wrong.
That's the net result of the kind of wisdom that this steward had, right?
Mm-hmm. It follows that, yeah.
So maybe not literally cynicism, but just a portrayal of this is, where are you going to hope, where are you going to place your trust in? Where are you going to put your hope in?
Good luck with that kind of thing.
He's putting the two against each other. In a sense, it's what he's been teaching versus this. Riches in this life or heaven. And they don't go. But he seems to do that in a lot of his teaching where he's trying to change people's thinking, their orientation, and how they perceive God and themselves and relationships, and just setting an edge up to what is real, what is good. Seems to be an example of it. It's something to make people stop and think, wow, that's different. And one of the questions I had was, who are the unrighteous? And I felt where you did with the publicans and the people that were not accepted by the high officials of the synagogue. That's the sick, those that were crippled and had some kind of admiration physically, maybe the poor, and those are the ones that are needy, they have need because they're not rich.
Yes, I find it pretty hard to take the point in verse 9 as something that Jesus is just offering. It's not something you want to post on your kitchen wall. And that's
promise
right. Promises from the Bible.
That's
not the sense in which it's given. With the context of what follows, he points to faithfulness. He that is faithful in that which is least. The thing is, the steward wouldn't have had any problem to start with if he would have been faithful. He wasn't faithful. That's what precipitated the whole thing. And then from a human viewpoint, he's smart. He's wise because he somewhat salvaged the situation by using the Lord's wealth to buy opportunities for himself on the way out. Not quite as powerful as a pardon, but it nevertheless is a way to use the means that you have access to, even though they're not yours. To use them in another unfaithful way to aid yourself. And You know, I think many of the people that were Jesus' followers at this point, and some have made the point that, well, Jesus wasn't saying this to his close 12 because they had left all. You know, they had left their nest, left the family, left everything behind. But there was a great multitude of people who followed him, who were his followers. And we saw in chapter 14, I believe it was, where he cautions them, if you're going to follow me, you're going to have to forsake all. That's where I'm going. That's what I'm all about. And if you're not taking that decision, if you're not following that path, it's not going to work. And so in this situation, you have people who are in that position of, what am I going to do? How far am I going to follow Jesus? You know, it's one thing to hang around for a day or two, but do I follow him beyond that? Do I, in fact, give up my way of life? What is comfortable to me? What I am secure in? Will I give up my security to follow him? For those who fail in that, for those who bail out, he says, well, you know, the best thing you can hope for is to have accumulated the goodwill of others you've done good to, that they may receive you into their everlasting habitations for whatever that's worth.
If I was a Pharisee, I would be asking myself, is he talking about me? Because the Pharisees went around in their special robes and their apparel. They did favors. There seems to have been extortion that occurred with the sacrificial rams and the animals that were brought in. They were very good with money, and their whole culture was what if. Thinking about the next step, the next step, the next step. Where was it going to get them? Where was it going to lead? And he did elicit a response from the Pharisees. We see a few verses from here. And so he doesn't call them out by name, but the question would arise, is he exposing them again and pointing out the difference between him and the kingdom of heaven and the false religious rulers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful in my mind that, you know, the Pharisees were the stewards mm-hmm. of what God was trying to give to the world. And so you can either be a steward to the master who has plenty, or you, if you're not faithful there, you have to go be friends with the people who owe the master stuff. So they're not only, those are the ones that have deficiencies. That's the best you can hope for.
And he does seem to introduce this idea of the two distinct worlds that he's dealing with in verse 8, where he talks about the children of this world in their generation are wiser than the children of light. So in this generation, so on the basis of the life that they're living in their walks and in their interactions with other people, they're going to be judged wiser. You know, they knew how to make the prudent steps to climb the ladder, to gain the political support, whatever the issue is, they know how to do that without regard to what's right, without regard to being faithful to a higher call, without regard to the treasure in heaven. And so it seems that he's painting the distinction between the path that he is calling you to follow him in and that path of the wisdom of this world.
If he keeps at it, he's going to bring the Pharisees down, maybe. This is a threat.
Yeah, for sure down on him, huh? Yeah.
I'm still struggling with 8. So some version says, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light.
Okay, think about it. The master has information this guy is not faithful. He's blowing his money. And he thinks he has him. I've got you. He may even have proof. I have proof that you have been unfaithful. What do you expect to be the result of that?
He's going to come down.
Well, no, that, but this person is at the end of their rope. They're going to humble themselves, maybe. They're going to go away in disgrace, something like that. Mm-hmm. They're out of options. This guy wasn't out of options. He said, I can make this work for me. Mm-hmm. And
sort of light, therefore, are you saying those who are following Jesus aren't looking for another way out or another shrewd move? Is that what he's saying?
Well, I mean, if you're dedicated to what's true, uh-huh. If you're looking for truth, it's like when you're confronted with the truth about yourself, you're humiliated by it. You want to fix it. You want to change. You want to repent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Not this guy. It's like, ooh, I see an opportunity here.
Yeah, and we're seeing that right before our eyes in government.
And you know what? He had a point.
Yep.
He had an opportunity, but how far will it take you? Mm-hmm. I think the everlasting habitations phrase is a little bit, it's close to cynical. Mm-hmm. How far are these kind of relationships going to take you? It's not going to be everlasting. Mm-hmm. They don't even have the resources to make it everlasting. And so in some ways, it's an invitation to consider the fact that this solution is not everlasting. Mm-hmm. It is very temporal. And the goodwill that you generate by this last act of unfaithfulness is not going to be a permanent thing.
That's fascinating, Keith. This is true today for a person who comes to the end himself or herself. They realize what I was chasing is not fulfilling. These people that I surrounded myself with, I can't trust them. Mm-hmm. They're not real friends. I've heard it from the sons. I've heard it from the testimony of others that they came to that point where this is a dead end. And this speaks to the everlasting habitations, because that's the image people are fed and feed upon, chasing sin, chasing the flesh. And hopefully the person comes to the end of himself and says, and sooner than later, mm-hmm. and says, this isn't working. This is a lie, mm-hmm. and I've been a fool. And they make that change.
But sadly, there are a lot of people in the world that it doesn't matter how hard they get hit, it seems like they're able to find the silver lining on the cloud, mm-hmm. and try something else. It's go this way, it's go that way. It's anything but face the truth of I'm wrong and I need to change. It's amazing.
I think what you mean by that is from the outside it looks that way. We don't know what's going on in their hearts and their minds. They may not have a teaching or a background that calls them to a change of mind. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes years or decades for life to catch up to a person who's, you actually see their life crumbling. We get a glimpse of it every once in a while in the news with the sports stars, with Hollywood. They don't really give the real and the full story. You see their relationships crumble. You see them fighting and hating each other and biting each other. Sometimes it goes public, but most of it isn't public. And the image that we're fed would be that, oh, that's wonderful, and isn't it great to be rich and have faith? So, and I can think of some people, some I've got to know better than others, that it just seems like they've always got opportunities. I get what you mean. I'm also thinking there's just a wake of destruction that follows, mm-hmm. this one person that most of us know, mm-hmm. that I'm thinking of. And things might look good on Facebook, but knowing reality, I don't think things are as good as what they look. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is fresh on my mind because I recently encountered somebody else, okay. like that one.
Okay.
And so they have personal charisma. They can sell screen doors to submarines, you know, and yet those doors don't work, and yet they find something else. You know, there's always an opportunity. Every calamity is an opportunity. They'll never face the truth about themselves, and that's sad and it's tragic. But you know, Jesus is offering something different. A kingdom which is built on faithfulness. And he says, he that is faithful in the least is faithful also in much.
Keith, just to add to that, because the thought's strong on my mind. It seems that a person like that has to move on. They can't stay in one place because they poison the waters around them and people will start to hold them accountable, so they have to move.
All right. You got to have new material, yeah, in terms of victims. Yeah.
Keith, in my head, I'm thinking this whole thing illustrates, too, that spiritually speaking, there's no such thing as the American dream. So, you will be a servant. You will either serve the master or you will serve those who are deficient. And as Mr. Bruce pointed out, they won't really be your friends, and they really don't have much to give you, even if they were your friends, because they're deficient themselves.
And so if you verbalize the American dream for me, that's in your mind.
Yeah, so you'll never be the master. There's no option. There isn't a third option. You will be a servant. It's a matter of either being the servant to the master or the unfaithful. You know, you can't serve God and mammon, but there's not an other option. Because in America we have this. Well, I know. I'll just become the top dog. That's not an option for any of us.
Well, it happens in Hollywood all the time, right?
Yeah.
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 I guess I'm still not. I think there is a misuse of the phrase "the American dream," but I guess I want to say that there's a legitimate idea of people being free to pursue what they value as a legitimate kind of example of the American dream. I mean, that you can come here and you have freedom to pursue what you truly value.
Yeah, so I think, you know, Matt's referring to that image of I can be anything I want to be. In America, I'm free to be what I want.
I understand that point.
Okay. Yeah. I was just going to say that people don't realize what they're serving. You know, in spite of the fact that they consider themselves to be free, they're bound by all sorts of images about expectations of others around them. Even, you know, some of these wild rock and roll types, you know, they want to give that image of nobody's got anything on me, I do whatever I want. And yet they're doing exactly what everybody else like them does. It's a culture, you know, they're all in their own culture, and they have a scale for ranking whether you're good, better, or best, or bad. And so they're playing a game on a different level. But they're still in the service of something.
And I've heard one successful, famous person talking about at some point you end up a prisoner in your own home. Mm-hmm. Because if you are wildly famous and popular, you can't go out in public. I mean, I guess if you have the resources to buy a private island, then you could, you know, walk around. But even then,
that's not public.
You can't go out in public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I refuse to become rich and famous.
Good on you.
The whole American dream phrase makes me think that many things like that that get mileage, there's a nugget of truth that people can latch on, and it means to them different things from other people, and that's what makes it so powerful. Mm-hmm. But it is good to define and clarify.
So if you process it in certain ways, this can be a very, very challenging parable. But I think given the context that we've shared this morning, and we see unfolding here in Luke, Jesus is presenting the option. This is the wisdom of the world. Here's an example of wisdom among the unrighteous. And if you're going that route, when ye fail, if you're going that route, this is the kind of everlasting tent you can expect. But the good news is he has riches of a different sort. Riches that deserve your commitment. Riches that won't fail.
Keith, I see a flow here, even back from the parable of the prodigal son, with the son amongst the hogs and the husks, and realizing he has no friends. He spent a lot of money, his riches, and when you're spending money, people tend to gravitate to it because they like the drink and the food and the good time. Yeah. But when the money was out, they were gone.
Yeah.
That's a lesson in life. That's human nature. And it kind of follows along here as a theme. I don't know if that was the main thing he was trying to get across, but injected into that was just a picture of human nature. Of
sure thing.
Deal with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got a couple minutes left, so I don't want to jump into something big. So, any other comments you might have about this? Don't. Yes. I was going to say I don't know that we've explained it to your satisfaction, but perhaps giving you something to think about anyway.
This, I guess, basically could just be a time filler, but
yeah.
it occurred to me that in certain situations, what this unjust steward did could actually be, business-wise, could be a good thing. If you have a list of creditors, people owe you, and cash flow is an issue, I mean, that can actually be something that would be a positive, where you contact your creditors, come up with a solution. Okay, hey, we'll write off a portion of it, and can you give us 50%? Can you give us 80% or whatever? But in this situation, this particular situation, it was kind of a last dig on his way out. But anyway, just occurred. It's not that is unjust all the time, every time. That it was just.
Left. Yeah, if you're the one that is the creditor,
yes,
and you offer that kind of generosity, it generates goodwill, and it's not a matter of being unfaithful with what is not yours. So there's a very real force in effect that Jesus is connecting to. That was kind of my first point.
In many respects, I mean, him going around in the name of his master,
uh-huh,
and giving away his master's money was just one more example of unfaithfulness.
Yes.
That's the part that really trips me up the most on this.
Yeah.
But it reminds me of the Jews. They're very shrewd people, but especially the religious leaders, these Pharisees. They could maneuver so well and keep people under them. They maneuvered well with the Romans to stay in power, mm-hmm, and dealt with threats, which Jesus was, and they eventually dealt with him. They're just very good at maneuvering. And this seems to speak of that maneuvers.
You know, that just hit me that the way they used their law probably created a culture of that, because they were constantly maneuvering to make the law say things that they wanted it to say or not say what they didn't want it to say. And that could have created, because I know even in our day, some people were very hateful about kind of a caricature of Jewish people. And I know they were forced to do banking because of so many different things in history. So some of it's unfair. But I wonder if the policy and the procedure of the Pharisees treating the law like they did, it's in our hands and we have to figure out what it says and maneuvering it, that could play into that. And, it's not that they were born uniquely corrupt
right.
from other humans, but just maybe their culture helped create that particular tendency.
Yeah. Jesus certainly offers an alternative, doesn't he? In the teaching about faithfulness, the teaching of selfless servanthood, those are ideas that they ridiculed and derided.
And, you know, I immediately go to myself and I think about, okay, now what has my culture and my upbringing or whatever, any of us have to look at what am I naturally okay with because this is my culture. Help me, Lord, see what is unique, because I don't think of myself better than Jews. There are certainly
right.
things that I have to be just as cautious about because that's human nature.
I think that's a good point. I think every family has that. Even good, solid Christian families, there's a culture that's accepted, and it's one that we need to question, to be open to question for improvement.
Amen.
Your assumptions in life get you in trouble a lot of times. Mm-hmm. So re-examine them.
Okay.
Well, thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Keith.
You're welcome.
Yes.
Keith.
Oh, I have an announcement. Lunch at Lars today instead of the Farm Bureau.
Okay.
Sorry to keep you in suspense there for a second.
I thought maybe you were going to get a letter.
Yeah.